I would like to begin by acknowledging the Gomeroi people, traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast takes place, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening.
It's just infected our community. It's a virus, a disease that's...
No, we're not going to accept this.
It's corrupting, and families become corrupted.
We were harassed.
Multinational mining company Santos has just been given the green light to start mining of the Pilliga region, a region home to the state's largest inland forest, sat above the Great Artesian Basin. Today, I'm going to take you to meet some of the community of Narrabri, a town divided by corporate tactics, but brought together and led by the strength of Indigenous Gomeroi women, who are standing as a beacon of hope. I'm Damontopoulos, and this is Mining vs. Matriarch. Beginning the journey, I had a stopover in a town called Bolga, a town which has felt the impact of a large mining corporation firsthand and been neglected by almost all of its original residents. Adlon Leslie is one of the final residents of Bolga and reflects on his own experience.
This community here, Bolga, as I said, half of it has been bought by the mine, the bottom half of the road, and the shop has been bought, service station, pub, that's all owned by the mine. We, some time ago, made a pact where we said, once the sun goes down, we're not talking about it. Because we don't want to go to bed at night with all of this stuff curdling away in your brain, because you can't sleep. It's terrible. It's that bad.
Because of precedences that mines create in towns like Bolga, there's a natural resilience towards mining companies in other regions, like Narrabri. In fact, Santos's project received the highest number of submissions in history, with around 18,000 out of 23,000 being objections. Professor Heidi Norman, leading researcher of Australian Aboriginal political history at the University of Technology, Sydney, explains that over a decade of planning and integration between Santos and the Narrabri Council occurs because of this.
They're not evil, but I guess they, you know, they, their intention is to, in order to gain support for a big project like this, they need a social license to operate. And so they come into town, they sponsor the local football team, they sponsor, you know, many things. They even, I was surprised to see the Santos logo on the police car. You know, I was a bit confused about why a logo of a multinational mining company would be on a police car, which is public infrastructure. I mean, we pay our taxes for the police force, not so that they can advertise a company.
According to Heidi, by unveiling themselves into the town and promising hundreds of jobs, the town then grows to have a dependence on them.
One way I think about it is that it's anemic. You know, you can see the economy has sort of drained out of the place and it's kind of anemic. So when the gas comes along, what's that? You know, they promise hundreds of jobs. It's impossible to resist.
Simultaneously, these companies plan how to combat and control any groups who pose a threat to the proposal, a strategy known as controlled opposition. Anna Christie, who has extensive experience as a research investigator focusing on the environmental impact assessment of mining and gas projects, explains this.
In the world of planning approval, they expect that people will oppose. They know it. They know that there's going to be groups, and their goal, and I know this because I worked for years for landfill organisation and then for large-scale, very loud music festivals that have a lot of environmental and a lot of social impacts. Mm-hmm. So that's the job I was doing, and it's very simple. You identify the different stakeholders, you work out, you map the stakeholders, you work out who's likely to do what, and then you focus on containing the opposition. Mm-hmm.
To provide a contextual example, Santos has placed 850 wells throughout the Pilliga, designated to the exploration of gas. When making a claim for these land exploration wells or for mining, corporations have government regulations they must abide by. One of these is having approval by a registered Aboriginal party, known as a RAP group, when attempting to assure that no Aboriginal artifacts or sacred sites are destroyed. The regulating rules around who can be a RAP group and the practical effects of a RAP group, however, allow for a controlled opposition within the Aboriginal community. Dolly Talbot, Gomeroi woman and leading voice for anti-mining in New South Wales describes how this occurs.
You don't have to be an Aboriginal
who pose a threat to the proposal, a strategy known as controlled opposition. Anna Christie, who has extensive experience as a research investigator, focusing on the environmental impact assessment of mining and gas projects, explains this.
And so you don't have to be an Aboriginal person to do that, which I find absolutely ridiculous.
This loosely constructed regulation provides anyone who qualifies to be a RAP with the authority to give Santos permission. This allows a falsehood of protection for the Gomeroi people, as they're invited to have a say in the mining process, but they'll only be listened to if what they say aligns with what wants to be heard. And if they object, then a list of 15 to 20 other RAPs are conferred upon until the permission's found.
Divide and conquer, so if they don't get the satisfaction as they didn't with our group, then they manage to bring who they want in that will tick those boxes. And, you know, whether it be from that clan group or outside that clan group or not, they're able to, under the guidelines, bring other people in and just do what they want to do pretty much.
This idea of divide and conquer was one which I heard a lot of when I was in Narrabri, specifically when referring to the local Aboriginal land councils, who were also RAPs for Santos. A line had been drawn between two camps within the land councils and wider Aboriginal community. One which was pro-mining and believed that the introduction of a mine would guarantee employment for local Indigenous people and secure financial gain for the Gomeroi community, and one which was anti-mining, believing that the land was to be prioritised over profit, that the employment of local Gomeroi people was an empty promise, and that Santos was, in effect, paying off the pro-mining land councils for their ticks of approval. Since Santos, or any other mining company for that matter, would only need the signature from one RAP to pass the requirement, and they had a list of all different RAPs, then they'd only need one land council to cooperate, in effect leaving the rest of the RAPs, or land councils, powerless and controlling the opposition. Sue Ellen Tai, a Gomeroi woman with a well-established footprint across Australia in advocating for Indigenous rights, believes that this stems from the deep-rooted history of colonial thinking.
It is very binary. It's like the have and have nots. It's if we have the gas fields, it'll solve your problems. And you know, and that's very limiting thinking. It's very and it's always in favour of the dominant person in that conversation. It always favours that person, because if Aboriginal people have got this thing, and this is generalisation, it's very generalisation, that because of the politics of the past and oppression and things like that, it's the expression is white is right, so that there's a generation that won't question so much now. There is the belief amongst a generation or certain generations of Aboriginal people that you can't beat them, so join them. So you've got to get the best you can and what you can and get all you can. For Aboriginal people, that's, you're not only fighting what happens to be then, for instance, you know, Santos with the gas fields, you also got generations and, you know, decades upon decades of oppression. You've got where you don't have a political voice and you don't have a political platform.
On top of this, the New South Wales and federal government have been working closely with multinational mining companies for decades. As Heidi Norman says,
you know, thinking about how mining companies operate in some parts of Australia and across the region here, they change governments. You know, they have the ability to completely change governments, change the political representation.
So when pitted against a multinational billion-dollar company who advantages from the structure of the political system, what other hope is there?
I'll pay anyone $100 if they see a koala.
What about the koala poo?
Koala poo gets 50.
Okay.
Tanya Marshall, I originated from the New England Tablelands. My family have always been in working for the government in environmental protection. So as an early teenager, I moved to Barradine, where my love for the Pilliga and Laird Forest, the northwest, the Wurrumbungs, became, you know, part of my heart. And I moved away as a young adult, and when I returned about 10 years ago, I realised that you know, the northwest region, my homelands was under threat to mining. And, you know, everybody has a friend or a family member in the northwest who's actually been impacted by mining in some way. So I just felt that I couldn't not do nothing. So I have an interest in koalas, and I've always been bushwalking and looking for koalas throughout my life. So, well, we started to find the koalas in places where mines needed to go, and that's kind of began my interest.
Tanya describes herself as a disruptive force against mining companies, now fighting for almost 10 years.
Whitehaven Coal are classified as, you know, in the top five polluters in the country, and if citizen science wasn't keeping an eye on them, that wouldn't have happened, because it's just a sad fact that the government don't actually have enough staff to monitor all the mines. Yeah. The community has to do it.
She's effectively taken matters into her own hands in ensuring that Santos abides by their environmental and cultural responsibilities. I went with Tanya and Anna Christie to experience firsthand what they do most days. First, on the drive from Narrabri to the forest, Tanya likes to begin with a traditional prayer.
By Army, hear my prayer. Guide us safely through the forest today. Give us direction. Show me how to be of service to protect this beautiful forest that we enter. Welcome my guests, keep them safe. Bless this earth. Yulu!
When we arrived at the forest, we took some time to sit at a creek that Tanya's dad used to bring her to as a child. We ate some food, looked for animal tracks in the sand, and admired the trees, which had been there for over 500 years. Being from the city, I don't get to experience this much. The forest hummed a lullaby of whistling birds and shushing trees, and the sky consumed 90% of my vision. Tanya has two main objectives when monitoring the mines. One, to observe any oil spills from the mines or drilling areas, and two, to look for endangered koalas in the area, which would be at a critical risk of extinction if the mine was built. Doing this with two people who are experts in the field, I learned quickly. Firstly, if the texture of the sand is crisp and flaky, and sounds like this when you walk on it, then that's most likely an oil spill. It's not hard to spot and not uncommon when walking beside many of the Santos sites. Secondly, if you find poo that's shaped like an olive pip, with both ends pointed and the middle round, then it's most likely koala poo. And if the pip-shaped poo is golden, then that's ideal because it means a koala's nearby.
If we're going to find koalas, you'll find them, they're always in like your Vs, you know, the forks usually. Yep. And it depends on the weather. I'd say this time of day they could be anywhere from the middle to the top of the tree. Mm-hmm. Really hot days they'll come down and get as much shade of the tree they can. Yep. Sometimes they'll even be in a tree that they don't eat just for the shade.
Oh, okay.
And this is like where we're going to find them. If we're going to find koalas today, this will be our spot.
Oh my lord. How old would a tree like this be?
I call this one Mama because look at its belly.
Koala paw prints, fresh prints found here at North Loop Road.
Last rain Sunday.
We had found our first lead. Creating an 100 metre radius around it, we searched through every poo sample and scaled every cypress pine tree. After an ambitious half hour of searching, I thought I'd found it. So poo in hand, I ran to Tanya.
Does it look like this?
That's wallaby.
Oh, okay.
But good. So we're looking thinner than that. Jelly bean, big jelly bean.
Okay.
I spent hours sifting through different shapes and sizes of poo, and I failed. The concept of looking for poo seems sarcastic, but it actually plays a pivotal role in protecting the forest and these animals. For me, the determination and persistence that Tanya shows in doing this every day and not giving up really shows the essence of the struggle. Tanya doesn't get paid to spend sunrise to sunset checking on every Santos well or drill. She does it to ensure that they remain in check with their environmental responsibilities. She doesn't spend hours walking through the forest looking for and assessing animal poo solely for her own curiosity. She does it to raise awareness and save these endangered species from extinction. The forest is her home, where she grew up and where her story is connected. For thousands of people in Narrabri, they didn't choose to spend their lives fighting, but they have to so that they can preserve their homes and their stories. But Tanya's story of not standing down and continuing the fight is reflective of the matriarchal power within the Gomeroi culture.
Women have always led the men into battle. Women have always led, you know, we've always been in the forefront.
Yeah.
Traditionally. Okay. So we're only doing what has always been a traditional thing to do.
Hmm.
We're a matriarchal society, you know. We have obligations, and we're just trying to fulfil those obligations.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something, I guess, that you choose to do, because let's face it, it's a bloody hard slog. And, you know, there's been many times when I've wanted to, you know, felt like I just couldn't put up with it anymore and I just want to give up. Mm. But I have an obligation to, you know, my children and grandchildren and all, you know, I've got nieces and nephews. The whole mob, we have obligations to all of them and to our ancestors.
All those women speaking out about their desire to protect country in the face of a multinational gas corporation, a national agenda that is pushing for that gas to be, you know, as part of the whole, you know, the nation's economic recovery. It's pretty staggering to think here are these sort of slim, feisty women who are on the front line of saying no.
I'm always optimistic. I think if I wasn't, I would stop. And whether or not we stop the mine, it doesn't matter, as long as you're trying to keep them as, you know, keep them operating under environmental, you know, proper environmental process. Well, I think you have wins every day if you're keeping an eye on them that way.
If there's one thing I learnt from my trip, and I hope that you take from this podcast, it's that your voice or input when fighting for something you care about is important. From leading protests to identifying Kualapu, the sheer strength, resilience, and optimism that the local Gomeroi community, particularly women, have shown is inspiring. The main purpose of this podcast is to reflect that and to bring awareness. So I'd encourage you to visit the Facebook page Gomeroi Traditional Custodians to raise support through petitions or by staying informed. If you find time, I'd also recommend visiting Narrabri for yourself and seeing the Pilliga firsthand. I'm Damon Topoulos, and this is Mining vs. Matriarch. Thanks for listening.